There, it's back on now. And this is Paul Rodell again, IBS Oral History Project. Today is, actually it's Saturday.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, thank you guys. That was a question. I should have put a question mark after it. The 28th of March, 1998, and I'm in the condominium apartment slash house, whatever, of Tracy Atwood. And his son is here too. I don't know if he'll be vocal or not. And probably not?
Yeah.
Okay. It's about 3 probably now in the afternoon. And we're going to talk about Tracy's time in, I hope, both Cambodia as well as Vietnam, because I'm kind of interested in that. He was there in first in Cambodia in 1963. You came back as a intern program thing in 67?
Yes.
Oh, good. That you're the second person I've seen who's done that. And then returned for a rather long stretch in Vietnam, 68, after the Tet Offensive, I think you told me on the phone, until the program, the IBS program, was terminated. And may have stayed a little bit after the official termination of the date, but I'll let Tracy get into that. So much for that basic introduction. Before I started the tape, I mentioned that I've got, you know, stuff that we didn't have on the form that I wanted to ask you, and as we've asked everybody, if you could tell us something about your own personal background, your parents, what they did, where and how they raised you to make you the young Tracy Atwood who'd be interested into going into Vietnam, and not only parental influences but others that made you interested in something like IBS. That's a big question, actually.
I was born in New London, Connecticut. I lived on a dairy farm all my life. My father was a farm manager, and we moved from Lyme to Avon Old Farms in Farmington, Connecticut, and then to Ferris Farms in Simsbury, then to Canaan, Connecticut. We called it Falls Village, but it's actually in the town of Canaan. And so we had poultry and sold fresh vegetables, strawberries, but the main line of activity was the dairy farm. And my father sold feed, seed, and fertilizer for a farm cooperative, Eastern States Farmers Exchange, which then became Agway. My mother did the bookkeeping for the business and took care of the family activities for myself and 5 other children. We had chickens also. My activities were, you know, very kind of traditional main line. I mean, my mother and father met in 4-H.
Uh-huh.
And so I was in the 4-H club, but then in high school in the Future Farmers of America. Mm-hmm. And my goal in life was to become a national officer of the Future Farmers. I was a state officer and had been to judging contests in Kansas City and in Waterloo, Iowa, as a representative of the state teams, had won a number of awards in the Future Farmers. In 1963, spring of 63, I was one of 4 Connecticut delegates to the National 4-H Club Conference in Washington, D.C. at the 4-H Center on Connecticut Avenue.
Oh.
And previous to that, I had applied for the Peace Corps. I had
what
a
year would this have been?
1963.
63. All right.
I had a friend from 4-H, uh-huh. Mark Ruette, was in one of the first Peace Corps groups in Columbia.
Uh-huh. So he was an older friend?
Well, he's maybe a year older than I was,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
But from a dairy farm in Torrington. His father was prominent in the farm circles in Litchfield County. and told me about, you know, Mark's experiences and how he enjoyed it and so on. And I was also very altruistic and thought that, you know, what one should do is try to serve and help others and so on. And so I filled out this Peace Corps application and got a response that said, well, it's okay, we think you're pretty good, but you're a little young, so we're going to put it in a hold category.
Why did they think you were young?
I was 19.
Oh, I forgot to ask you your birthday. So, yeah, so...
February 3rd, 1944.
So 44 and then 63. Yeah, you would have been.
So I was okay. Here at the National 4-H Club Conference in Washington, and my state 4-H Club leader, or assistant state 4-H Club leader, Noreen Ray, you know, heard that story, and she said, well, have you ever thought about IVS? And I said...
Have you ever heard of it?
I said, IV who? And she said, IVS. So she said, well, let me call them up, and maybe they'd like to talk to you.
Who was this person?
Noreen Ray.
Noreen Ray, where was she then?
She was the assistant state 4-H club leader in the state of Connecticut.
Oh, and she just happened to know about this.
She just happened to know about it, and she called up, and I went over to the IVS headquarters, wherever it was at that time. I didn't know Washington at all.
Probably somewhere near where you were, because I think it was on Connecticut or something.
It wasn't too far. I'm not sure whether I did that or whether they came out to the 4-H Club Center to interview me. Anyway, it was Russell Stevenson and Gordon Brockmiller.
Oh, what do you know? Okay.
Russell Stevenson, who used to be in the ADS, Agriculture Development Council, ADC. What was that, a predecessor to Rockefeller, but he also was with Rockefeller.
Uh-huh.
He was the program officer, and Gordon Brockmiller, I guess, was like the executive or whatever. They both interviewed me.
So that's, okay, yeah, I was trying to figure this into the chronology, because he had been there, and by that time, he had already turned things over to Luce.
No, Don Luce wasn't there.
He wasn't?
No. No, I mean... Don Luce would have been in Vietnam then.
Yeah. I meant turning things over to Vietnam. Don in Vietnam.
Yes,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah. They gave me an application form, and I took it back, and I went back home to Connecticut. Had another couple of weeks to finish out the end of the second semester of my first year of college, and of course a lot of exams and. Mm-hmm. So I filled out the application and didn't think much about it and sent it in. And a few weeks later, I got a call and they asked if I would like to go to Cambodia. And I didn't know where Cambodia was, but I said...
Give me a map.
I said, yes, well... So we then went to the library and got books to try to find out where Cambodia was. And I tried to do some background. Had orientation in... Washington, John, whom he's out in Harper's Ferry, he was one of the persons there, and Cliff Doak. Cliff's now at USDA. We left from here, and I got to Chicago, and they wouldn't let me on the plane didn't have my cholera shots. back in Connecticut, one doctor had told me something about, I guess he thought cholera and plague were the same things, and so.
Aren't they?
No, they're not. In other words, the local people were not that well schooled in these kinds of tropical diseases. So I had to fly. Everybody else got on the plane and went to Tokyo and then on to Cambodia, and I had to go back home to Connecticut and stayed there a week and went on a bus into Hartford to get my cholera shots.
let me kind of just pause for a second here for a couple of reasons, because I wanted to, before we get on too far, you said, I've got one thing to ask you and then one thing I forgot to tell you before I started the tape. The thing I wanted, what I forgot to tell you before I started the tape, was we asked people to sign a release form, which gives us the right to quote you from the tape. It's a legal nicety. Mm-hmm. But the thing I forgot to ask you, what you mentioned, I didn't want to interrupt, was you said that you had this humanitarian impulse.
Right.
I don't know if you used the word impulse.
Yeah.
Why do you think you had that? What was it about you, your makeup, that went in, you know, whatever it was that made you, that gave you that kind of...
Because that's the way my parents were. That's the way, particularly my mother. And you know, we went to church every Sunday and sometimes went to two church services and Sunday school and the whole thing.
So a heavy religious influence?
Well, a strong religious influence.
Okay, yeah.
And my mother was always doing things for others and helping others. And I just thought that that's what I was supposed to do.
What religion?
Congregational.
Okay. Because as you know, so many people had been either Quaker or Mennonite.
Quakers or Mennonites, yeah. No, I was not one of those.
Okay. Well, that's... See, when you said the religious thing, that the antennas went up. And I wanted to see, you know, if you come from that background. I mean, I've also, of course, interviewed many other people.
Just old line, very traditional New England.
Okay. All right. Because, as I say, I've interviewed other people who were other kinds of Protestants and Jews and Catholics and such. So, I'm not trying to put the humanity, the good impulse only with Quakers and Mennonites.
A week later, I then flew on to Tokyo and was met by a fellow named Don Schmidt, who was working for Meals for Millions, who had the IVS office. John Hughes.
Okay.
John Hughes set it up so that at least I was not totally alone. In that, I had a stopover in, I think it was Tokyo, and then flew on to Cambodia. Somebody from AID actually met me at the airport. It was sometime in September of 1963. Stayed at the IVS house on Baitsa Pramui Trasak Paim, which is number 27 Sweet Cucumber Street. Stayed there for about 2 weeks and had some orientation. And George Eason was the chief of party.
George Eason.
Yeah, right. And a little bit of language training, and then was taken down to the livestock station at Stung Kayo.
How would you spell Stung Kayo?
Stungkeo.
Okay.
Two words.
I might ask you to spell these things out because we frequently have students doing transcriptions, and so.
There were five other IVS volunteers down there at the time when I arrived. It was a livestock station. It was an AID project. The livestock station was being developed. It was being carved out of the jungle.
Uh-huh.
Land cleared, stumps removed, pastures seeded, buildings being built, and so on.
Who were the IVSers who were there?
Tom Wickham was there.
Tom was there, okay.
Ben Wenger. But he left about the time I got there. He was from Buck, Pennsylvania. He was Mennonite and mostly worked on the equipment. Harlan Gross, and then went to work for Purina in Hong Kong for years. John Bateau.
Bateau.
B-A-T-T-O.
Uh-huh.
And Charles Simmons.
Uh-huh. We haven't sought out people who were only in Cambodia.
Charlie Simmons then went to Vietnam, although perhaps not with IVS. I mean, he was then joined AID.
Yeah.
Tom Wickham, not long, it wasn't, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a month after I was there, Tom Wickham left.
Yeah.
And went to Lampot, Ratanakiri, in the northeast of Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure what kind of project he was on. So I did all kinds of, I was not in Cambodia all that long. I took over the task of trying to milk the water buffalo. Sihanouk had purchased something like 12 water buffalo from India, Murray water buffalo with curled horns that are used as a source of milk. Some of the largest dairies in the world are in Bombay, composed of Murray water buffalo. Sihanouk thought that it would be nice to have milk production in Cambodia. So these buffalo were assigned to this livestock station, which was under development. So worked on trying to make some sort of a stanchion arrangement and then trying to milk the water buffalo, which was difficult. They kicked hard. Lots of interesting experiences with them. There was an interpreter who helped us, and I studied language in the morning, and then in the afternoons, went out and worked. In November, so it was like end of September or so when I got there, and then by 1st of November, things began to kind of deteriorate. It was fine on the farm, but 1st of November 1963, Ngo Dinh Diem was assassinated in Vietnam. Uh-huh. And then a week or two later, Sirit Thanirat, the Prime Minister of Thailand, died, presumably of old age. And then when about the 20th of November, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Uh-huh. But prior to the assassination of Kennedy, sometime in the early part of November, Sihanouk captured two Cambodians wearing camouflage fatigues and with American weapons and American-made backpacks and so on. And he put them on some sort of a show trial in front of the National Assembly, which he convened. Uh-huh. They usually met once a year, if at all, so he convened a special session of the National Assembly.
To show this trophy.
And said, and made the big gestures, how can we accept aid from the Americans, who give us aid with one hand and stab us in the back with the other? And he made gestures like that. Uh-huh. Now, I don't know whether these two fellows were, supplied by the Americans. I mean, the material such as that was certainly available on a black market. And since there were military activities going on in Vietnam and in Laos, I mean, one could have picked up both the weapons and the backpacks and so on. So I have no idea what it was. He was always concerned about Sun Ngoc Tan and Sam Sri, and one or the other of them. One was operating in the southern part of Vietnam, and the other one in Thailand. They were broadcast by one or the other of them into Cambodia, in Cambodian. They were critical of the king, and he was very unhappy about it. It's quite likely that the Americans were financing these radio stations. For what purpose, I don't know, whether they wanted to destabilize him or whatever, but...
So Sun Sri would be S-O-N-S-A-R-Y, and the other...
Sun Ngoc Tan, N-G-O-C, T-H-A-N-H. And he had a brother, Sun Tan Nguyen, so he would have been, those are Vietnamese.
Yeah, I was going to say, Nguyen, that's Vietnamese.
Vietnamese names, but I think they were Cambodians, certainly broadcasting Cambodian. Some of the, there were special forces in Vietnam and in the Delta areas. Special forces always, they were called them CIDG, Civilian Indigenous Defense Group. And their special forces camps were made up of the local population. So in the Delta areas, they would have used Cambodians. So it's quite possible that these folks could have been from, there are a lot of ethnic Cambodians in the Delta area of Vietnam, so they could have been legitimate Vietnamese citizens in a special forces camp in Vietnam and, wandered back across the border and got picked up. Anyway, Sihanouk said, you guys go home. He said he had one of his speeches that was a marathon, as I remember, something like 6 hours. I recorded just a little bit of it on a tape recorder, a real tape recorder I still have. At home in Connecticut, and he got really excited. He used to speak longer than, as we remembered, than his competitors for that type of thing, Sukarno and Castro.
Fidel, yeah. Fidel with the 13-hour speech.
He would, you know, as the speech went on, you know, then he would sometimes have French and Cambodian and English all in one sentence. And he would start out in one language and then shift to another, and his voice would get higher as the speech dragged on. But he said, I don't want any more American aid. Go home, Americans. Go home, Americans. Go home, Americans. You know? And he had these two Cambodians, you know, kind of on his show trial. And he said, we can't accept any aid, can we, from, you know, these people that say they're our friends, and they give us aid with one hand, and they stab us in our back, and with the other hand, we can't accept any more aid, can we? And everybody, of course, yells, no. So that was it. I mean, from that,
whipping up the crowd.
From that point on, 11:49 on whatever was the day, it was about 11:49. I mean, that was it. That ended American aid in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, I understand that Sihanouk, you know, then began having some second thoughts because about half of his military was paid with funds that came from the U.S. So, I didn't really mean that. You know, maybe you can continue this or that. Well, that was it. Now, I was doing my thing down at the livestock station and had, not concerned about these international politics, but then one day, maybe a week or so later, someone appeared, an aide person, in a Jeep, and said, okay, you've got 2 hours to pack your stuff and we're leaving, that's it. So, I put my stuff in my trunk or whatever and drove to Phnom Penh. The IBS house by that time was full because they brought people in from the various provinces, and there wasn't room enough for everybody all at one time. Now, so they put me up in the Mondial Hotel, and I was by myself. I came down the next morning, and the desk clerk said in Cambodian, and my Cambodian wasn't that good yet, and he said something about my president had died. And I was relatively sure that I didn't understand him, that my Cambodian was just not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
That afternoon, when some people came over from the IBS house, they told me that Kennedy had been assassinated.
Uh-huh.
So I actually had understood everything that the desk clerk said, but it was...
Didn't believe yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it was incomprehensible to think that, I mean, it's just a total shock.
Uh-huh.
So, and he also brought some mail. I'd had mail that had been collecting at the IBS house. There was a letter from my father and said that my cow, Dolly, my favorite cow, had died.
Uh-huh.
So I got pulled out of the livestock station. the possession that I had the strongest attachment to, Dolly, had died, and my president had been assassinated. So my...
Hell of a way to start the day.
The world was kind of, turned on end. So we, after a while, there was room enough at the IBS house. Some people either left or went on vacation or whatever. And so I moved into the IBS house, learned to play hearts. And we sat for days and put the trunks on the floor and used those as tables and played hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Wickham went off on a vacation to Australia. Took a long time around.
Along with Shaker.
Okay.
They went together.
Yeah, all right. And we had visits, they were trying to figure out what to do with us. We had three choices. We could go home, we could go to Vietnam, or we could go to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
I had only been there 2.5 months or so, and I just didn't think that, it was time to go home. I mean, it had only just started. We were... visited by Walt Coward, who was the chief of party in Laos, and he told us all about Laos and the opportunities to work there. And I think it was Don Luce that came over from Vietnam and told us about Vietnam and what opportunities were there. And so I finally decided I would take the Vietnam option.
Uh-huh.
One other incident, while we were sitting there in this IBS house, with nothing to do, some of the volunteers, particularly Marty Klisch.
That could be for you.
That's all right. Oh.
We could pause this if you want to.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. I can even turn it off. Turn it off. Back on again.
Marty Klesch was working at a place called Cherry Dong, which was, I guess, not that far from Phnom Penh. Mm-hmm. And he very much wanted to continue. So there were 10 or 12 of us who composed a letter to Sihanouk saying, we are volunteers with the International Voluntary Services. We are not AID. We are not official U.S. government. We would like to continue to do the things that we came over to do. Wouldn't you please let us stay? And somehow through the Asia Society or someone, I mean, someone had contact with someone who worked in the president's office, and the letter did. Not everyone signed it. I signed it. And it did get through to Sihanouk. After a week or two, I mean, a reply came back.
From Sihanouk?
Well, from his office or whatever. Okay. I mean, it said, yes, we know who you are. We know what you're doing. And it's all right. You can stay if you want. But it has to be with no, you know, no U.S. government funding. You have to be strictly, you know, independent.
Yeah.
Well, of course, most of our funding was U.S. aid. So Marty stayed on. He stayed on for a year or two until he was, yeah. Well, then he went to Laos after that and was later killed in an airplane crash. But most of the funding came there, some from church groups and some from the Asia Foundation. He stayed out and he, as we saw him about a year later, he came over to the IVS office in Vietnam. He said it was a lot easier after aid left because, you know, then he didn't have to always report to aid. And the people in the U.S. Embassy still was there in Phnom Penh, and, you know, every now and then he checked in and let them know that he was still there.
You said that you saw him about a year later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you go on to Vietnam?
No, I went on to Vietnam, but I mean, at some point...
I thought in 63 that you would have gone back to the United States.
No.
Oh. So you finished out that first tour in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I thought you went home and then back to school.
No.
Okay, all right.
No, while we were waiting to determine our fate in Phnom Penh, one of the missionaries from the Christian Missionary Alliance, Don Furness, said, gee, would you folks have anything to do? And we said, no. Wouldn't you like to come with me down to my house in Takeo and help me put screens on? So we said yes. So Ben Wenger and
more interesting than hearts.
Myself and one other fellow, I forget who. And we did. We went down there for a day and worked on putting on screens. And on the way back, he had a Volkswagen microbus. On the way back, we were approaching the bridge at Ankh Thasam. It's a long bridge, one lane, fairly high over the river. Curve going on to the bridge, and as we started on the bridge, there was a big Cambodian bus coming up the other side. We were on the bridge first. Don Furness did get the vehicle stopped and actually had it in reverse when the Cambodian bus hit his head on, and I went through the windshield.
Huh.
The two, I think it was John Bateau and Ben Wenger were in. They got out of the back and actually sat on the back bumper so the thing didn't fall in the river, and it was apparently teetering on the, and went through the, was pushed through the guardrail. After some time, I guess passengers that were in cars that were coming up on the other side, somebody came along and provided transportation. I guess took me to the hospital at, the Furness couldn't get out because the steering wheel was banged up on his leg, and he broke his leg, I guess. But my nose was broken. The bus, I'm sure that part of the rationale, I mean, the Cambodians got themselves all psyched up. Sihanouk wanted to have everybody, you know, rejoice at the death of Srettharat, the great enemy. So he decreed that everyone, every Cambodian, must wear a pink ribbon to show their rejoicing. Even our cook at the IVS house, when she went to the market, was forced to buy a pink ribbon to put on. The Sikh loads all had pink ribbons on. And this bus had a pink ribbon up on the top of the front. They're all required to do that. And, you know, I really think that maybe, you know, the bus driver saw that it was a vehicle of foreigners and just had no intentions of stopping. I mean, hit us head on. Anyway, my nose was broken, and I just remember that the next morning when the doctors in French, you know, said, pulled the bandage off and said, how does it look? I said, well, it looks a little crooked. He said, you shouldn't complain. Last night it was over under your right eye. I had my little book in my pocket where I was learning Cambodian words, and I would write them down. Mm-hmm. I still have that at home in the attic. It's got, you know, blood on it. Anyway, about a week later, went to Vietnam, mm-hmm. and one of the first things that happened was the Christmas party, the annual Christmas party at the IVS house in Dalat. It's up in the highlands, and that was very nice. And then after the Christmas party, I mean, it was John Summer actually lived in the IVS house where we had our meetings.
So you were at the Christmas party in
Summer. Yeah, over the back fence was the house that belonged to Madame Ngoni Nu.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently a year or two before, when they'd had their Christmas party up there, some of the IVS boys had gone over through the backyards and invited her to come up there to the IVS house where they were having a hot dog roast. And there's a picture of Madame Nu in her white aozai with gloves and so on, holding this stick with a hot dog on it. Now, they claim, you know, makes a nice story anyway, that's where she learned the word barbecue. Now,
okay.
Madame Nu, of course, is famous for, you know, when the Buddhist monks burned themselves of saying, I mean, using the term barbecue, referring to, you know, their self-immolation. So, Christmas.
Of course, I think she had been to the United States enough so that she probably picked up barbecue long before that.
Had she been to the States?
I think so. Had she?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Her English was very good. I mean, beyond textbooks, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway. But it's a good story.
Well, it was a good picture.
I'm sure it was a great picture. I'd love to see it.
So I stayed in Dalat for a couple of weeks and was to have, you know, kind of on-the-job orientation with a fellow named Dan Leedy. And Dan Leedy at that time was just kind of finishing his IVS term and moving on to be the aid province rep. I stayed at the IVS house there. John Summer lived there. He was an English teacher. I remember with Dan Leedy, one of the places that he went was the Montagnard Agricultural Training Center at Dam Pao. You have to go down the mountain from Dalat to close to where the airport is and take a right, which would mean going west, and 20 or 30 kilometers down the road, and there was this, and there was a special forces camp and a village, and then this Montagnard Training Center nearby. When we were there, you know, there was a fire burning down a lot of the houses. Of course, with these thatch houses, they burn quickly. And Dan took tents and food supplies out of the USAID warehouse, old, must have been leftover World War II army trucks, and drove it down. I think this was on a Sunday or whatever, and I went with him. And on the way back, you know, the lights went out. And I remember going around those curves on that road and holding the flashlight out. That's how we got up. Luckily, there were no incidents.
Don't you drive like this, John.
Well, it wasn't safe to just stay there along the road.
Well, no, I know, but...
So then, I guess I went back to Saigon, and my team leader was Mike Chilton. I think he's out in Idaho or someplace like that, maybe Wyoming, Idaho, probably.
I think it's Idaho somehow. Yeah. When you said that, it clicked.
And I was assigned to Gwangduk Province, which is in the central highlands, largely inhabited by Minang people, an ethnic minority. There were some Vietnamese there, but not very many. There were, I'm trying to think, it was either 13,000 people or 26,000 people in the province. I mean, it was the least populated province in Vietnam of the 44 provinces in South Vietnam at that time. So, I can't even remember, we couldn't drive up, I mean, it wasn't safe to drive up. I think that we flew to Ban Mi Thuot, and then drove from Ban Mi Thuot down. And who was there in Ban Mi Thuot? Roger Sweeney, working at a technical high school, I think, and Gloria Johnson doing home economics. Mike Benj was around somehow, although I'm not sure that he was in aid anymore. And of course, Chi was staying at their house. He was a high school English teacher at the time, Bui Zung Chi. He had been the interpreter and the language teacher for Don Luce and others. We went out to a village, a Montagnard village, a Rade village, and they had some sort of ceremony. And we drank rice wine. I didn't know what it was, and Mike Chilton kept telling him I wanted more because I liked it.
and you couldn't tell what he was saying.
Well, no, I mean it was fine. I didn't feel anything. The problem was,
until you stood up.
Well, it was something like that.
Yeah. I've had rice wine too, and it's fine until you stand up.
Actually, you know, there's a little anecdote. Back in Cambodia, we lived in a Cambodian house, style house, although it was made out of wood, up on stilts. And this particular house had the under area, there was a cement platform,
okay,
which is where we ate and so on. And I think there may have been screens around it. But one of the early meals there, we all ate together with a Cambodian cook that, of course, it was mostly rice and some sort of soups. And there was this little jar of things, and I asked what that was. And one of them, I don't know whether it wasn't Tom Wickham, maybe Harlan Gross, someone said, oh, that's like bacon bits or something. I mean, put some more on. I put two or three, you don't want just one, put two or three. It was the very small peppers that are very, very hot.
Mm-hmm.
and I bit into, took some rice.
Make jalapenos seem like cucumbers.
And I was in total agony.
Yep.
The sweat.
And they were laughing.
They laughed for probably about 5 minutes. I could hardly breathe.
I've done that to people. Yeah.
I could hardly breathe. The sweat running off my forehead. I mean, drinking water even wouldn't do any good. I mean, anyway.
Plain rice. Plain rice and yogurt. That's the only thing.
They thought it was a great joke.
I mean, yeah.
Just trying to orient me, I guess.
Yeah, sure did.
So in Quang Duc province in Vietnam, there was one aid official, Bob Cormier. He was the aid province rep. And he may have had one or two assistants, but local people, Le Van Loi. So there was no place. There were about six cement houses in the province, in the capital, Zang Yen. So Mr. Cormier and I stayed in the province guest house. It was fairly close to the province chief's house.
Was this one of the cement ones?
This was one of the cement ones. I can't remember where I ate at that time. Maybe he fixed food or had somebody fix food for him. I was assigned to, you know, develop a Montagnard Agricultural Training Center. There was a program to do that in the various provinces in the Highlands. There was a period of time where I tried to determine where this should be located in working with the province officials, principally the deputy province chief, Lei Quang Quy. The province chief was Lei Van Tan. Finally, it was determined that there was a site near the Special Forces camp at Bun Sarpa that would be appropriate. So I went out there and started work on trying to clear land and construct some. I think there was a building there that could be used as a dormitory. And then trying to hire staff or somehow get some staff that could be trained and set up some training courses and bring people in, working largely on vegetable gardening and trying to, one of the other main tasks was trying to work on training buffalo as draft animals. The Montagnards did not do that. They did not.
Sarpa?
S-A-R-P-A.
That doesn't sound Vietnamese.
No, it's Buon Sarpa. That's
B-O-U-N?
B-U-N, yeah.
Yeah.
That's...
Or is that Lao?
No, that's a Rade. That was in the Minong area, but it's that... The Minong usually call it Bon, but the Rade call it Buon. Uh-huh. Bat Mituat is Buon Ama Ituat, the village of the father of Ituat, which became corrupted to be Ban Mi Tuat. I suppose the French just pronounced things more rapidly.
Yeah. And then it got shortened and lost the
Buon Sarpa. Buon Sarpa was halfway between Zhangye and Ban Mi Tuat, which was about 120 kilometers, maybe 60 kilometers in Lactian. Can't even remember the name of the district. Tuklap district. About 11 kilometers away, there was a French tea plantation. There was no gas stations in Zhangye, so I had to drive to Ban Mi Tuat every couple of weeks. And I had a couple of barrels that I put in the back of the Jeep and filled up with gas in Ban Mi Tuat and came back. So I got to see the IVS folks in Ban Mi Tuat quite often. We had had some training courses at this training center, and then one time I was coming back from Ban Mi Tuat with gas and supplies or whatever. I think it was August, maybe about August 20th or so, 1964. It was late. I should have started earlier. It was not safe. I mean, there was a war going on, although not much in that area. It wasn't safe to drive after dark, and it was getting close to dusk, and so I stopped at the Special Forces camp. And when I was working at the training center, I stayed at the Special Forces camp. Slept on a cot in the team house that they had. They had two team houses. This was a split A team. An A team has 12 soldiers, and so they were split. There were six of them were there, Buon Sarpa and the other. The other six were also in Quang Duc province at a I can't remember the name. Buprang. They were at Buprang, which was close to three frontiers, a little bit further south in the province. On this particular night, after we'd eaten in the team house, the meals were interesting there. In fact, the fellow that was the cook there had been, used to be the houseboy for Don Luce.
Oh, really?
He really was not much of a cook, and they ate kind of locally, and so that have fried chicken that would be in a bowl, and if people didn't really like the necks and some of the other things, you know, they'd eat the parts they liked, and so when a new food was prepared, it was put in the same bowl. Pretty soon, then, after a number of meals, the bowl was just filled with chicken necks. Because the other pieces got eaten. Anyway, after supper that evening, the company, the battalion commander, Imut, came in. And he said something about there's going to be some problems tonight or whatever, but don't worry, you will be all right. And we didn't know quite what that meant. You know, it's like, does that mean that there's going to be some sort of a Viet Cong attack?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had no way of knowing. I went to sleep in the team house. There were three or four bunks in one on the one side of the little central building where they ate, and then on the other side there were another three or four bunks. Anyway, about 1 o'clock in the morning, there was a lot of noise, and someone came in, and they told us to get up. I just remember that they kept saying, "This is our night. We kill Vietnamese." And it was a revolt of the Montagnards against the Vietnamese. It occurred in five special forces camps all at the same time. It was planned. Anyway, they marched us out. There was a lot of shooting going on inside the camp. There were maybe about 400 Montagnards in this special forces camp.
But the camp was Vietnamese?
No.
Okay. Well, then, what Vietnamese were they killing?
The officers.
Okay. All right.
The special forces camps had American advisors.
Okay, so it was really a Vietnamese army sort of thing.
Well, the Americans were the advisors to the, I guess, the Vietnamese military, who were the officers, and the soldiers, in other words, the cannon fodder, were the indigenous population,
okay.
In this case, the Montagnards.
Yeah.
So there were four companies, and they each had a Montagnard company commander, and there was a Montagnard battalion commander.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also Vietnamese officers. So
okay.
Usually when they went out on patrol, the Vietnamese didn't go. The Montagnards went out, and the Vietnamese stayed back. I mean, that created a lot of resentment. There were, the history of the Montagnards and the Vietnamese, I mean, there were many reasons why they felt that revolt, I guess, was the only way. The Vietnamese didn't give them much consideration, tried to change their names, did everything they could to, you know, put them down. The history of Vietnam, no one remembers Champa. It was the Kingdom of Champa. The Vietnamese kind of overran it, as one professor described it. The Vietnamese killed the men and married the women. So thus in Quang Ngai, Quang Nam, Quang Tin, the people are a little bit darker, and they speak more of a dialect of Vietnamese, which was because it was a Cham area, heavily a Cham area. And the Vietnamese had been more or less kept out of the highlands until after the end of the French Indochina War in 1954. And so, in fact, the French ruled it with a statut particulier. Kept it as a kind of a separate area. Then the Vietnamese in 54, of course, then began to move up with a vengeance, if you will. The first thing that they did was created land development centers called Dinh Diem, which is very typical of the Vietnamese. If you look at how they moved from the Red River Delta in the early part of 800s, 900s, or whatever, and they moved slowly down the coastal area and then into the South Vietnam, they would establish colonies maybe 200 kilometers out in front of where their population was. So they were called Dong Dien.
Southeast Asia kibbutz style.
Well, they were established out in, you know, the hinterland for the purpose of, and then people who were criminals or, you know, misfits or whatever, you know, okay, well, here's your chance. You know, you go down there or, you know, you're in jail, that kind of thing. And it was a way of annexing territory. And they just kept doing that all the way down. Well, in 1954 or shortly thereafter, there were, of course, about 1 million Vietnamese came south from North Vietnam, largely Catholics. And so there were some of those that were established in settlements in the highlands. But also they had these Zindian land development centers. And they brought people from overcrowded areas of Quang Ngai, Quang Nam, Quang Tin, very heavily, densely populated on the central coast. And they put them in a series of settlements along the border in the highlands. So in Kon Tum, in Pleiku, in Darlak province, in Quang Duc, you had this, if you looked at it on a map, you could see that, you know, obviously it was a strategic consideration. Now they were, at least in Quang Duc, they were supposed to be planting rubber. Mm-hmm. And they had rubber trees. None of them wanted to be there. They were from the coast. And after I arrived in Quang Duc was after Ngo Dinh Diem had been assassinated, and I remember one of the early times going out with the province chief, Le Van Tan, and he went out to one of these land development centers, and he was speaking, pleading, cajoling with the people, saying, please stay, you know, even, you know, we will make it better. And the aid province rep was trying to, you know, bring in supplies, bring in things to, you know, try to encourage them to stay. You have land and, you know, when the trees grow and start producing, you'll be better off. And I remember living in Zhangye, and we would see these folks, you know, walking with their, you know, that staff that the Vietnamese carry and bundles on their backs and so on. They picked up and walked back to Quang Ngai and Quang Nam. They just left those land development centers.
Didn't take it.
Well, they said Ngo Dinh Diem was the one that made us come out here, and mm-hmm. he's dead, so, you know, we don't have to go, we don't have to stay anymore. Mm-hmm. Let's see. That doesn't get
that. That would be. So, did they feel insecure, or was they just didn't like the life?
I was foreign to them.
Yeah.
They were from the coast. They're lowland mm-hmm. people. They're not mm-hmm. the highlands. Mm-hmm. They were forcibly moved. I mean, forced resettlement. You know, even in Indonesia has never worked very well.
No, but I was wondering if there had been a security problem at that time.
No.
No, it wasn't. Okay.
Well, I mean, there was some, but I mean, that's not why they were moving. It was not a security issue at all. Some of the settlements of people, the Catholics from North Vietnam, stayed, but they were not put out on the border area, like the land development centers, peopled by people. People coming from the central Vietnam. Anyway, back to Buon Sirpa.
Yeah.
They marched us to the team house. You know, it was a distance of probably 10 or 15 feet from the front of the building where I was sleeping. And as I walked there, I mean, they had their guns out, walked up there two steps onto the little veranda. And I remember, there was a Vietnamese who was the interpreter for the Vietnamese contingent in the camp, the 10 or 12 officers, the non-commissioned officers. His name was Trong. And he was on the ground, and there was somebody standing there on the edge of the veranda, and the ground was maybe 2 feet below. And we were walking up the steps and then onto the veranda, kind of behind this Montagnard who was there. And he had a grease gun, that's what they called it, with a big long clip in it. And he unloaded that clip into Trong's back. Mm. And I remember his arms flew up and his legs kind of flew up. And, I mean, he heard him yell something about no and or whatever. And anyway, I was scared excrementless because I thought that he was going to, you know, take that grease gun and just continue right around and, you know, eliminate us. He didn't. So then I breathed again, and they marched us into the team house. And we sat on the floor. They took my jackknife, because they said they didn't want me to commit suicide. Of course, that was the last thing in my mind. I didn't do anything like that.
You wanted to stay alive.
Yeah.
Oh, is John going somewhere?
No, somebody's at the door.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I was there for 2 days. I don't know. At one time I asked to, said I had to go to the bathroom and wanted to go out and take a leak in the, there were outdoor urinals or latrine. Mm-hmm. Captain Darnell, who was the American Special Forces commander there, said, told me, well, I better not go into the latrine and just go out and pee behind the tree.
Uh-huh.
He'd been out earlier. Apparently the Vietnamese that had been shot, they threw him in the latrines. And there were there at least nine in that. The firing went on for about an hour while we were there inside the compound. And of course the Montagnards did completely take over and took command, and the Vietnamese that didn't resist or whatever, I mean, were, you know, tied up. Next morning, I remember they went up to...
So they didn't kill them all?
No. I mean, those that resisted, I mean, where
yeah,
they were
yeah,
fighting.
Yeah, yeah,
they went up to the district headquarters of Doklop and picked up the people there. Is that for us?
I thought it was...
You sure?
It was for Seth.
Oh.
Sounded almost like it was here.
Maybe it was here. It
would be really loud. Huh? Okay.
I remember one of the first things the next morning, of course they had every weapon in that compound out, and you know, they all had weapons on. And they said, Dapir, and there were planes that came over. And they pulled their ponchos all off their machine guns and submachine guns and so on. And they were looking at that airplane. They didn't fire, he didn't quite come low enough. And there was an observation plane was coming over to look.
Uh-huh.
To see what was happening. While we were there in the team house, the Montagnards, at one time someone came in and tried to explain what was happening.
Uh-huh.
And he spoke in French, and it was translated for us. He had a flag. We had three stripes. If you look in the National Geographic, where you see my picture.
Yeah.
That flag is there. And it had three stars on it. And he explained that those, they called the moon Bajarako. And he said those three stars were for the three oppressed groups that had been oppressed by the Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
The Montagnards, the Khmer, and the Chams. Now, later on, you know, people had the interpreter, and they had some sort of a flyer, a manifesto. Later on, people said, well, that was for the three Montagnard, major ethnic Montagnard groups in the highlands of Vietnam, but that's not the way it was explained on that particular night. Captain Darnell tried to have radio contact with the other half of his team at Bu Prang. And what did they say? They had left or were leaving the camp. I mean, that camp had been taken over by the Montagnards there. And they were heading to three frontiers where they were supposed to meet up with a regimental size unit coming from Cambodia, which never happened.
Uh-huh.
But and the most of the, or a large number of the soldiers from Buon Sarpa left sometime in the middle of the night after they had secured the camp and went to Ban Mi Thuot. We all sat and listened to the radio. They wanted to listen to the radio. The revolt had occurred in those two camps, also in Bum Brien, in Ban Don, I think, and in Bujiamap, I think was the other one. they had Bunmi to it surrounded on Sunday morning, and at 7 o'clock they were going to take over Bunmi to it.
Uh-huh.
Bunmi to it was the headquarters of the Vietnamese 23rd Division. But the Montagnards knew that on Sunday morning the Vietnamese soldiers would all be asleep, which was certainly true. The signal for converging on Bunmi to it was going to be the radio station announcement at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
It never happened. When they took over the radio station, the Vietnamese who was in there apparently pulled some switch or pulled some plug, and
yeah.
So the radio station was
disabled.
Was disabled, and they never met. So they sat around Bunmi to it and never quite converged on it. Of course,
mm-hmm.
Then the Vietnamese became very concerned, and of course the Americans and whatnot. And it was very tense. The whole the revolt continued for about a week
mm-hmm.
and a half, and the Vietnamese put all of their energy into it. The president even coming up to Bunmi to it, you know, assigning generals and so on, and they gave more attention to that than they ever did to trying to fight the Viet Cong. They initially tried to say it was, you know, Viet Cong inspired. It wasn't, and it had nothing to do with the Viet Cong. I was in the camp on the helicopter came down from Bunmi to it the first day. A jeep came down, and some American, and said, gave us some news. Supposedly, this whole thing was being led by Ibrahim Inouye, who was a deputy province chief in Bunmi to it, who had been in prison for 6 years previously for, Montagnard rights activities. Although I don't think that he was really the leader, I think he kind of got drafted because they were looking for somebody to negotiate with the Vietnamese, and so they pulled him in as the most likely person.
That doesn't mean he had anything to do with it.
That's right. I don't think that he did. On the second day, a helicopter came in from Bunmi to it, and it landed just outside the compound. There was an American colonel, Fritz Freund, and he had something to do with Two Corps. He came in, he started, trying to take control. He got up on a jeep.